producer James Sebastian Scott and I were joking that the show today is going from booze to drugs, but neither subject is one that should be taken lightly. From our conversation of moments ago, and so much feedback from you on it, that the federal government is considering lowering the legal limit for blood alcohol content from 0.08% to 0.05%, we move to a community very close to our own, just down Highway 7. It's a 20-minute drive on a good day, and to Guelph, where we find not the opioid crisis that we talk about so much here in the region of Waterloo, though I'm sure that opioids and fentanyl are an issue in Guelph, but crystal meth continues to be the quote-unquote crisis that police and support workers are talking about. Rachel Doyle is one of those support workers. She is with Stonehenge Therapeutic Community, and she joins us this morning. Rachel, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Let's start with just the Stonehenge Therapeutic Community, if we could. What is it, and what is it that you do?
So we provide many different services at Stonehenge Therapeutic Community. We have both community programs as well as residential programs. So we offer long-term residential program up to 4 to 6 months for both males and females. And then we also offer a variety of different community programs, so everything from supportive housing to supporting people who have more complex mental health and addiction needs.
When it comes to the drug problem in the city of Guelph, are you raising this issue of crystal meth because of what we're seeing Ontario-wide with opioids, or is crystal meth actually still the biggest problem?
As far as I see it, crystal meth is still our biggest problem in Guelph. And as you said, by no means does this mean that we don't have concerns around fentanyl and carfentanil. But crystal meth absolutely is still very, very running rampant in Guelph. And we see a lot of individuals, both young and old, continuing to use it quite heavily.
What's the impact, Rachel?
Well, crystal meth in particular is a central nervous system stimulant, which basically means that people can use it for days at a time. And because it's a stimulant, they may be up for days at a time and not eating or drinking very much during that time. And as a result, it can have a significant impact on one's mental health. You can imagine staying up for days on end does not do wonders for anyone. So couple that with the effects of the drug, we can see people becoming quite distressed and agitated, sometimes paranoid, and it results in behavior that they may not have engaged in otherwise.
Is it visible, Rachel, for people walking the streets of Guelph, which I love to do? It's a beautiful city. Can we see this on our streets?
Absolutely, and I would say the difference between crystal meth as opposed to fentanyl, because it's a stimulant, it's going to look different. So people using crystal meth present differently. Oftentimes, it's a stimulant, so they're walking around, they have quite a bit of energy, and as I said, you might also see people who may be engaging in some strange behavior or who might seem a little suspicious or paranoid. So those may be individuals who are engaging in meth use, as opposed to fentanyl, which is a downer, so people are much more less likely to kind of move around and be seen and heard, as opposed to crystal meth, where it's a much more active drug. People are much more active on it.
So one of the things we've talked about at some length in and around the opioid crisis, that as we've documented, it's not just here in the region of Waterloo or Guelph, it's really Ontario wide, maybe nationwide at this point. But as we continue with these conversations, Rachel, we get into sort of the root cause, and we talk about what may be leading people into turning to drugs for whatever kind of escape it is they're looking for. What can we say about some things that maybe you have identified that are leading people to turn to a crystal meth or some other form of drug.
Well, and you've got it just right. I mean, people don't use substances for no reason. So typically there is an element of pain in their life, whether that be physical pain or emotional pain. We know that the same areas of the brain light up in response to both physical pain and emotional pain. So really, the brain does not discriminate. If a person is in pain, they're going to look to something that can help them cope and to mask and to deal with that pain. So physical pain aside, there are lots of emotional reasons why an individual might use substances. So we look at intergenerational substance use, intergenerational trauma, mental health concerns, homelessness, poverty. All of the reasons, all of these reasons can drive an individual to use substances for that short-term relief. Unfortunately, we know that then the consequences in the long term are detrimental.
Is crisis too strong a word to describe the situation with crystal meth in Guelph right now?
I don't think it is, and I think you can have multiple crises happening at the same time. So I think for folks who have been working with individuals using crystal meth, it has been a crisis for quite some time. And again, that doesn't take away the fact that we are also dealing with a fentanyl crisis, but the crystal meth crisis certainly has not gone anywhere, and we still see a lot of people who are using and noticing the detrimental effects and, of course, not able to access any kind of treatment or support in a timely manner to help them cope with their issues.
So what is it, Rachel, that the city is doing right now to deal with this crisis?
Well, I think there are a bunch of different initiatives that are happening in an effort to deal with this in a more holistic way. So, for example, even providing housing for individuals, providing the basic necessities of life, because, again, that translates to if I can't eat or if I don't have a roof over my head, I'm in pain and I'm going to reach for substances. So finding programs like housing, support services, and easier access to treatment, so increasing the amount of staff and places at treatment agencies so folks can get in more quickly. So all of these solutions, unfortunately, take time, but we are noticing as a community that we recognize we can't simply throw people in the justice system. That's not taking care of the problem. We need to deal with the issue in a more holistic way.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the old way of thinking about it, isn't it? That we can't deal with these people in the judicial system. This is not a problem, be it crystal meth in Guelph or opioids here in the region of Waterloo or whatever. It's not a problem we can arrest away.
Absolutely right, because we know that doesn't solve the problem. I mean, for a period of time, you may take that person off the street, but then when they return to the street, they typically have way more barriers now that they've been involved in the criminal justice system in trying to make their life better. So it's even more difficult for them to, for lack of a better word, climb out of that hole. And so I think, just as you said, we're recognizing that the judicial system may play a part in this, but we know that the response needs to be much more holistic if we want people to be able to achieve any kind of long-lasting recovery or sobriety from substance use.
This is challenging, Rachel, and forgive me, it's kind of getting speculative to some degree, but you're on the front lines, and I have conversations like this on this show frequently, and we've talked about, as you mentioned, the holistic approach, which I could not agree more, is absolutely necessary. The fact that people are turning to drugs because of other things that are going on in their lives. It would be foolish, wouldn't it, to think that we can eradicate a drug problem? So, and you can say we could wipe it out entirely if you wish, but I'm wondering, where are we headed here? What do we hope to get to as communities?
I think more compassion when it comes to having conversation around substance use and trying to really understand what is driving people to use, because as we've touched on, arresting people or putting them in the judicial system does not take care of the problem. So I want to believe that we're moving more in a direction where we have more of compassion and understanding as to try to figure out where these people are coming from and why they're using, and addressing those needs as opposed to just kind of slapping them on the wrist and giving them some jail time. So I hope that's the direction we're moving, but it does take time.
It sure does. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense, though. Rachel, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Rachel Doyle. She is with Stonehenge Therapeutic Community in Guelph. Meth use has exploded in popularity in the fine city of Guelph since 2012. Now, we have documented almost weekly of late on this show, and really, we have heard the calls in this community for resources and for efforts to deal with the opioid crisis. And I want to stress, it's so important. This is not unique to the region of Waterloo. The crystal meth crisis that Guelph has identified and is now dealing with is not unique to the city of Guelph. The drug culture has changed considerably over the years. And I don't know where it's headed and where we as communities can hope to end up. I believe that it would be foolhardy to suggest that we can live in a drug-free community. I just don't think that's possible anymore. I heard an interview. I think I may have related this to you prior, so I apologize if you're hearing it for the second time. But I heard an interview with a 19-year-old woman who is currently on a cross-country speaking tour trying to get her message across to her peers, people her age, which I think is a noble effort because you're much more likely, I believe, to listen to a peer. And her message is about the dangers of opioids and fentanyl. And in the interview, again, it's a 19-year-old woman, goodness gracious, but she was talking about coming home from work and routinely, on a daily basis, popping a couple of pills. And then one day, instead of just a couple or three pills that she popped, she took 8 or 9. And the follow-up question, which I thought was brilliant on the part of the interviewer, was, what was going on that day? What was going on during the day in which you decided 2 or 3 pills isn't enough, I'm going to take 8 or 9? And the answer really wasn't a good one at all. There was nothing different. She just thought that she had become so accustomed to the 2 or 3 pill habit that she could handle 8 or 9. And if it wasn't for a friend that found her non-responsive on text messages that then alerted the proper authorities, this young woman, 19 years old, would be dead. Hence her decision to take her story on the road and try to reach her peers. When I step back from that story and I think about it for just a moment, I ask myself, what is going on in a person's life at the age of 17 or 18, because this woman was clearly using for some time before she almost overdosed. What is going on in that life whereby it becomes routine to come home from work and pop a few pills? How does that become your reality? And I'm not trying to judge you on that. I'm asking the question sincerely, and that's what we come back to in these conversations now, when we hear from Rachel Doyle at Stonehenge Therapeutic Community in Guelph about this holistic approach, when we talk to Rachel and others about this not being a problem we can arrest away. Remember the conversation we had with the Crime Prevention Council right here in the region of Waterloo in talking about the opioid crisis and how preventable it may well have been because the signs had been identified some 10 years ago. If we're looking for the root causes, if we're looking for the things that lead us down the road to 2 or 3 pills every day, that's where we can begin to address the problem. But now that we're into the full-fledged crises, be it crystal meth in Guelph or opioids here in the region of Waterloo, what do we do about it now? I have heard from so many of you that are concerned about the places you're taking your children because you're finding drug paraphernalia in parks along community trails. That's where we're at now. I'm certain that there are areas of your city that you try to avoid because of the prevalence of drug use in those areas. That's where we're at now. So when we begin to unravel all of this and get back to the root, only then do I feel we can begin taking steps in the right direction. It is a complex problem, but imagine that, from opioids here in the region to a full-fledged crystal meth crisis in Guelph. How are we going to unravel all of this? Where are we headed? What would you like to see happen in your community with regards to the drug problem? And I'll just leave it at problem, because we have one. We have one here in the region of Waterloo. We have one just down the road in Guelph. What would you like to see happen? *570, 519-570-2545, or 1-800-570-5715. We'll come back with your thoughts after this on the Mike Farwell Show here on 570 News and Rogers TV.
Put the smart in your smartphone. Download the 570 News app and stay informed. 570 News.
For folks who have been working with individuals using crystal meth, it has been a crisis for quite some time. And again, that doesn't take away the fact that we are also dealing with a fentanyl crisis. But the crystal meth crisis certainly has not gone anywhere. And we still see a lot of people who are using and noticing the detrimental effects, and of course, not able to access any kind of treatment or support in a timely manner to help them cope with their issues.
Crisis is not too strong a word, says Rachel Doyle of Stonehenge Therapeutic Community in Guelph when referring to that city's crystal meth problem. It's opioids in the region of Waterloo. It's crystal meth and opioids in Guelph. What do you want for outcomes? Let's find out if they're achievable. *570, 519-570-2545 or 1-800-570-5715. Dina, good morning.
Hi there. So I think that the thing we're joking and kidding ourselves about as a mother of four children is, you know, the bottom line is I've had some of my family be addicts over the years. Two of my cousins have passed away in the 80s club scene in Toronto due to one was AIDS and one was hepatitis. And then I've seen it even here in Waterloo region. Just even my daughter, who's 16, has one of her friends that's not able to come to school until the afternoon because his parents have to get him what he needs to get through the day. And he is a total meth head. And he is 16 and he is going to our schools in the region. He has been exposed to drugs, and everybody around my daughter's friends, because they can't get booze and it's easier for them to get weed, and weed turns into whatever else. And people that say, you know, weed is not addictive, that's fine, but they are looking for a high and they're always going to push that envelope. And what we need to do as a community is either get a stronger handle on our personal drugs in our homes, because opiates are in many things. Opiates are not something you just see on the street where you see the movie Intervention or the show Intervention. They're in the Tylenol 3s of the world. They're in all different types of things, of painkillers. You have a thrown out back and then you've left, you know, 50 tablets in your closet. Your kids' friends find out about it. Next thing you know, they're gone. There needs to be a better security system within your own house. It starts in your house. You ask the questions. It gets ugly, but you get in their face and you ask them all the time. And I know I do. And our drugs are locked in a secured, almost like a gun case. Like, not, it's not a gun case. It's a large stand-up security system. And every single thing, right down to Advils, are in there.
Yeah.
You can take 40 Advils, you can take 50 this, or they squish them up and they snort them, and it is in the East Bridges of the world. It is in the North Waterloos. It's in Lakeshore. It's everywhere.
I hear you, and I appreciate the phone call. The conversation's absolutely beginning in the home. Be vigilant. Be tough on your kids. But I think it goes further back than that, even. Being in the East Bridges of the world, for sure. But what is driving, if we're talking about your children, to go into the medicine cabinet looking for whatever it is they're finding, right? To Dina's point about pushing the envelope and always looking for that next high, that's the part that is of greatest concern to me. That's what I was referencing earlier. I mean, gone are the days when it was just, you know, some marijuana in the high school locker, right? I think anyway. John, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to see money confiscated during drug raids and things like this put towards drug rehabs, towards housing. I mean, coast to coast nationally, there's tens, hundreds of millions of dollars in drugs, you name it, proceeds of crime confiscated. Instead of going towards police gadgets and weaponry and this sort of thing, put it right towards the people who need this stuff. And when it comes to prisons and jails, more scanners and dogs, not only to scan prisoners going in so they're not so-called hooping drugs and bringing them in, but so that guards and staff aren't the ones bringing drugs and things into the prisons, because they're getting there somewhere. It isn't just the prisoners bringing this stuff in. We all know this. Guards get caught all the time. And people in society must learn that drugs have been here forever. They're not going away. Alcohol is a drug. Tobacco is a drug. These things are totally legal. We can go buy them, use and abuse them, unless we're driving a car. And I won't get started on that, because if you want to murder somebody, just drive a car, run them over, and you'll get a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, we had that conversation earlier this morning, too. John, I gotta cut you there, because we're already over time. I appreciate the call. I don't have a number of the proceeds of crime in terms of the figure, but it's an interesting, rather utopian view. Let's just apply proceeds of crime to diversion programs. It's kind of like saying, let's have a lottery system in Ontario, and we'll use that to pay for health care, which we, you know, anyway, it's a whole other story. I'm sure some of it does go to hospitals, don't get me wrong. Just saying, don't buy the ads, if you know what I'm getting at. Okay, we've had a lot of heavy stuff. We've hit you pretty hard with drunk driving and the drug problems, and I want us to do that. It's important. I mean, we can't ignore it. If we bury our heads in the sand, we do so at our own peril, and I'm sure you recognize that. But we'll take a bit of a break from the really heavy stuff, and we're going to talk to a photographer that I've been really looking forward to chatting with. And I have to credit Louisa D'Amato for bringing him to my attention. And he's going to be Louisa D'Amato, the columnist with the Waterloo Region Record. Stefan Rose is the photographer. He's going to join us in studio, and we're going to talk about the things he's photographing and why. And it's the why that I think will interest you the most. So stay with us. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News and Rogers TV.
570 News brings you airborne traffic reports for your morning and afternoon commute with Daryl Dahmer on 570 News.
So credit where it's due. I like to give that. And Louisa D'Amato of the Waterloo Region Record gets the credit for bringing to my attention Stefan Rose, who now sits here in studio with us this morning. So why don't we just start with a nice good morning, and thank you for coming in.
Oh, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wish I had spotted you on the street at some point with your camera and then kind of sparked a conversation and got you in here. But that's what Louisa's column was all about. And you have been photographing with a vintage camera, no less. Describe the camera to us and why you choose to use that as your instrument.
The camera is a 1927 Corona panoramic camera, and it takes a sheet of film that is 8 by 20 inches in size. So the camera is totally old school, like you would see in the movies now, with the accordion bellows at the front and, you know, big wooden frame on it and a very large-looking lens on the front. And I use a black cloth over my head to, you know, be able to see the image on the ground glass at the back of the camera before I put in the film holder.
So in a world that has gone completely digital, more digital than I ever thought it could be, you still go to this antiquated technology. Why?
The resolution of it, basically the image, because the sheet of film is 8 by 20 inches in size, I mean, that's a very large plane to, you know, deposit an image on.
Right.
So because it's molecular at the film level, you know, it's a silver compound in small particles, so it records the image in a way that the digital pixels, which are very discrete, defined, separated out points on a sensor, you know, they do it differently from a kind of randomized pattern of how the silver grains are arranged on the film.
Right.
So I don't have to enlarge the photographs. I can just place the processed film, the negative, onto photo paper, and then the image is a one-to-one reproduction. There's no enlargement required to get so much detail and smooth tones.
What do you do with all of these wonderful full-size photographs that you're taking?
Well, I print a small portion of them. I just haven't had time to print them all. I'd keep on making more and more. Quite often they get exhibited in different galleries. So, for instance, the last year at Wilfrid Laurier University, I had an exhibit of 15 of these photographs of street scenes or buildings around the Waterloo region up on display. And, you know, arranged in a grid with views of when buildings were, or what buildings looked like a few years, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and then through the process to where they get torn down and become condominium buildings, for instance.
Right.
So that's a show that of some of that work. But some of the other subject matter I've photographed has been, sort of former military forts in eastern Canada, and in Ontario and Quebec, and then writing poems based on my understanding of the history of those sites and of the time that they were built.
Right. I wanted to dig deeper into the why, and, mm-hmm. and that exhibit you mentioned at Wilfrid Laurier University is what really caught my eye when reading this in the paper from Louisa, because I'm a local kid. I'm a Kitchener kid, born and raised, love this community, and I've recognized the change. That's obvious, says Captain Obvious. But before I get to that, I just want to finish on the photography itself, because to call it a hobby almost diminishes this, given what you put into it. But truly, it's not your livelihood. This is something you're doing for the pure enjoyment of doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I've studied fine arts and photography and sculpture at university, and I haven't been able to make a career out of it. The life of artists can be a little difficult.
Sure.
But the motivation behind doing this really has been because I've been a long-term resident of the cities. I've seen the changes happening, and in the neighborhood around, or you know, around King Street, around you know various other points, I've seen those changes happen, and we have to have the progress. But I'm interested in seeing or documenting what happens, you know, to a place as it changes and
right.
grows. And, you know, there are things that happen within a community that you don't expect or that show up. And you kind of tilt your head and you wonder, okay, what happens next? Or what was this before?
Right.
You know, some people may overlook these places.
So I've got two favorite examples of that of my own, and they're both on King Street, and mm-hmm. one still stands. So maybe you'll get a chance to photograph it before it's gone, because I'm not sure it'll be there forever. But I'll share those. And one's now long gone and transformed into something very new, which is also and you can't even see a shell of the former place. There's my little tease that we'll get to. One of the buildings that you were recently photographing was, and I just passed it the other day. And, you know, it's funny, Stefan, because when I did and I saw the sign out front that said, thanks for 62 great years, I thought, wow, 62 years. But it had been there as long as I can remember. And I'm referring to the small little, it's almost like a DQ hut, quite frankly, on King at John in, I think we're calling it Midtown, just as you're getting up into Uptown Waterloo. But it has closed its doors. It was open right through last summer, but now it's gone. And you were photographing that because you suspect it's, as a structure, it may not exist much longer?
Well, given the economics of running a small little business like that and the challenges that many business owners along King Street have had because of the LRT construction.
Right.
You know, little sites like that or, you know, storefronts that become empty because the business can't survive from lack of traffic, there's a great likelihood that they will disappear. We've seen along that stretch of King Street Victorian houses that get knocked down to put up six-story condominium buildings. So it's, you know, I want to make sure that that very specific type of architecture that I've seen, or that we recognize and know, doesn't disappear without having a proper record of it.
We just spoke yesterday with the managing director of a company called InFlight here in the region, which is further towards Kitchener in Midtown, but across the street from Grand River Hospital. You talk about one of those old homes. They have transformed that into an office. So the home itself, the structure still exists, but now the guts of it, of course, are not a dwelling, a residential dwelling in any way. It is a business space. So the building stays, but it has been repurposed for our modern age today. When you look, Stefan, at these buildings, and I think of this Dairy Queen, for example, because across the street, there's a dry cleaner. And like when you think of that area, if you're on King Street in that area, you can, it's almost like going back in time to some degree, because you can feel that neighborhood. Like I said, that DQ is really small compared to what we've got here at the Boardwalk. There's one full service and you're going to get all your food there. I believe all you were getting was your ice cream. Not that that's a bad thing, but you've got your little ice cream shop. You've got your dry cleaner across the street, and you can almost feel 60 years ago when you're on that area of King, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah. In fact, I did a project back in 2009 that got exhibited at Kitchener City Hall, which was photographs of dry cleaner buildings in southwestern Ontario.
Right.
Because they are of a specific business. I mean, they're a very specific business model that is under stress from the wrinkle-free pants and, you know, other clothing that doesn't require dry cleaning. And so even while I was photographing during that project, there was one dry cleaner that I thought, okay, I'm going to come back to this when the light is just at the right angle. And I didn't get back to it, you know, to the place for maybe 3 weeks. And it was closed down at that point. You know, it closed down within that three-week span.
Right.
So there are these places that are disappearing from the economic landscape. And, you know, those small examples are still hanging on, but they may be gone at any minute.
This exhibit, Stefan, of 15 or so photos that are at Wilfrid Laurier University, do you have a favorite, or what were some of the others besides, I mean, recently you're photographing Dairy Queen on King and John in Midtown. What others have you taken a closer look at through your lens?
I think there was a Kitchener Glass building at Victoria and almost beside the expressway.
Yes.
Just across from the Burger King.
Yep. That's right, because that's been gone now for the new Highway 7 project.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that building has been rather nondescript in a way, but that's something that people have seen every time they got off the expressway, or they wanted to make that turn onto Highway 7. And I thought, well, it's disappearing, so perhaps I better photograph that. And so I've got a photograph of the building before it got demolished, and then a photograph of the partial demolishment and this giant pile of gravel that was, you know, left behind.
I was just in the area the other day, and it actually struck me because you put it so well when you talk about if you get off the expressway to go up Highway 7, you're sitting at that light. The Burger King's on your right. You're staring straight at now the pile of rubble. And I had forgotten Kitchener Glass. I remember there being like a quick oil change place on the one side of it as well at one point. But interesting. Yeah, now the building's completely gone. It's not like it's going to become a condominium. That's gone now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested in, you know, what these places are, you know, before they disappear, because there are certain styles of architecture that we've seen over the past 100 years that become transitory, or they disappear to make way for the new. You know, we keep on going for the new, but sometimes we overlook that some of those things are of a specific style that maybe worth hanging on to.
So if you look, let's come into downtown Kitchener for a moment, because there is a lot of architecture, period architecture, and I'm no expert. That's my uncle's domain, so I won't even try. But you can tell, obviously, there is a certain style. And I can only imagine, I mean, the former Bud's store, for one example, that's been bought and being renovated, and we know it's going to turn into something else. But these facades, Stefan, that we may take for granted in downtown Kitchener. Are you photographing them now? Do you have you already? Do you plan to before they get transformed?
Some places, yes, I will. I'm not looking to make a grand inventory of everything in the downtown or around the region. I'm interested in looking for different kinds of examples. So not everything, but some different examples.
Right.
One of the buildings that I hope doesn't ever disappear would be the former TD Bank at the corner of King and...
Benton. Is that the one you mean? The one where there's a Krabby Joe's restaurant
yes,
in there now?
Yes,
yeah, that's right.
So, you know, that building, that piece of architecture is really distinctive for the region, for a bank building.
Yep.
You know, it's very distinctive from the old CIBC bank building further down King Street East. You know, that's... I can't remember what it's been turned into now, but...
Yeah.
You know, there are all these examples of buildings that I think are really interesting from an architectural standpoint that, you know, it would be a shame if we lost those things.
That former TD that you just referenced at King and Benton or Frederick right there on that corner mm-hmm. reminds me, it's similar, I think, and I'm trying, is it a pub, they call it the Public Works Building, but it's directly across from City Hall at Gockel, which is also a beautiful century-old, for sure, structure that still mm-hmm. stands as originally erected, I do believe. Yep. But that's another one that I hope we can find a way to preserve as mm-hmm. as we move forward with all of this.
Yes, or even the old Legion building that...
Which has just been sold, we've mm-hmm. learned, on Ontario Street.
Yep. That's yeah, I mean, that type of brickwork, people aren't doing that anymore.
Right.
So, you know, if we can preserve some of those things, that would be interesting.
Is there a building, Stefan, that you particularly miss?
Not really, no.
You're not a sentimentalist at all.
I'm not terribly sentimental. I'm not necessarily nostalgic for the past.
Yeah.
I have an interest in architecture and an interest in the built environment and how people interact with it. And also the sense of place and sense of community that builds around these places. So, you know, I'm always interested in figuring out what it is that makes a place tick. And I've been here in the city for many, many years, so I've had different ways to try and look at how to photograph or how to express artistically, whether it's through the series of photographs or through series of poetry as well. As to, you know, what it is that, you know, tweaks something inside of my head and, you know, maybe worth expressing.
I'm very interested in that sense of place as well. And I can go back to places that I knew as a child that have transformed entirely now, but still, I'm obviously more nostalgic than you. But I can, because they can bring back those memories of what used to be there and what that place had meant to me. And when you look at what's happening now, I mean, the progress, I'll point to the corner, the intersection of King and Victoria, which mm-hmm. having just reopened, and I drove it the first weekend, like many of us did, I think, just for the idea that we could drive it again after almost 2 years of closure. But that mm-hmm. is a remarkable transformation there. Will our sense of place, how we identify with that place, fundamentally change now because of the place it has become? It's brighter, it's bigger, it's a much different place than it was.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, the fact that there are more buildings going in that are putting more people into the downtown core, whether they're working there or they're living there, that adding that density into there will make it a more vibrant place regardless.
So, yeah.
The fact that it has had that facelift to it and, I mean, a lot of reconstructing or, you know, new construction. It creates a different character from what it was. For those of us who've been around for a very long time, you know, we may remember fondly having to, you know, pull on the parking brake on the incline up towards the tracks,
sure.
waiting for the train to go past, whereas now we can just sort of scoot under the tracks and not have to think about that kind of infrastructure anymore.
Right, and from one fast food to another, the McDonald's that used to be there at King and Brightup is gone now. That's mm-hmm. one of the ones that shuttered. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll keep Stefan in studio with us just for a few extra minutes because he's got nothing better to do than talk to us about his photographs. But I'm going to tell you one of my favorite places from a bygone era that's now as new as as can possibly be, plus another that maybe you can photograph before it's gone. Because I am a nostalgic old fart, I'll tell you that. This is the Mike Farwell Show. Stay with us on 570 News and Rogers TV.
John Wilson's Weather Guarantee. Weekdays at 7:11. Only on 570 News.
In studio with Stefan Rose, he is a local photographer who has been documenting buildings before they disappear. One of his most recent, the Dairy Queen at King and John in Midtown. You know the one. It was there for six decades. Of course you do. I got an email saying an old building that should still be standing, Kitchener Old City Hall building on Frederick Street. That one, I think you mean the one, the old one, wasn't it on Gockel way back in the day? I think that's the one that the emailer is referring to, because the one on Frederick Street, the building itself is still there. Mm-hmm. City Hall was just kind of built in. They used office space there is what they did before they built the jewel that is on King right now. Okay, I'm going to tell you, Stefan, one of my absolute favorites and one of the buildings I miss terribly, and that was the A&W Drive-In Restaurant. Do you remember it?
No, I don't.
King and Weber in Waterloo. It is now Chapters. So that Chapters that is there, and it's a pretty busy corner, obviously. You got a couple of gas stations there, and I think it's the Harvey's on the other side of the street. But in where now the Starbucks and the Chapters are, which is a sign of modern times, there was an A&W drive-in restaurant where you'd go there and you would get the orange tray hung off the side of your window, and absolutely loved it. And then further up King, and this is the one you might still have some hope for here, on my behalf, of course, is beyond Conestoga Mall. There's across from St. George Banquet Hall. So we're almost into St. Jacob's territory now. But across from St. George Banquet Hall, there's still a little house that's still there, yellow brick, and my family used to rent land as a garden plot. So we would grow vegetables for the family of five hungry kids out there. And next to that is a little white church. I believe it's a Mennonite church, and a little cemetery beside it. And that, too, it looks like it's seen better days, but it's still standing. That one might be worth it before progress takes it away.
Yes. Yes, as we expand our houses and subdivisions out further into farmland.
Right, and I'm amazed that the house is still there and this little church is still there. But it really does speak to a bygone era. And we've got this interesting mix of rural and urban in our community. And you're the one that's out. What motivated you to even begin this documentation process?
I guess about at least eight years ago, the Bauer buildings started to get knocked down. So, right. a huge complex of buildings that was being demolished. And I thought, okay, this is part of our history, our heritage that is being demolished and made to disappear. We used to joke that the Bauer Felt building was... it was the dust factory, because as you'd walk along King Street towards John, and there would be the windows, those classic industrial style,
yes,
small rectangular panes in the windows, and they would all be sort of coated with dust on the outside edge from all of the felt and stuff that they were using there, that started me on the path of photographing these sites. And as I started to see what change was happening there, then I started to get more focused on other sites that were having the same thing happening.
Yeah, you've got a fondness for Midtown, though, because that Bauer building also in Midtown.
it's walking distance for me.
There you go. I could talk about this all day. Sadly, we are already out of time, but thank you so much for coming by.
You're very welcome.
Where can we see your stuff if we were so inclined?
My website, stefanrose.ca, is a site where you can see the images. Unfortunately, the show at Laurier has come down. But in September, there will be six of those images going on display in the Laurier Toronto site.
Beautiful.
At 130 King Street.
Okay.
So
we will make sure that we will tweet the link to stefanrose.ca so people don't get the spelling wrong and whatnot. But and I'll continue to enjoy. I'll be a fan from afar, or maybe from a near, and I'll call you back once in a while for these chats, okay?
Okay. Fantastic.
Stefan Rose joining us in studio to talk about some of those buildings that used to be here, and some are still here, and they're not going to be here much longer, but we're documenting them on old school film. I absolutely Love it. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News and Rogers TV.